Coming up on Tech News Weekly, we kick things off with an interview from The Information's Wayne Ma about how Apple has suddenly started spending a whole lot more money on conversational AI, but how the company has actually been working on this for some time. Then I have my first story of the week, all about the EU naming its gatekeepers. And boy, the Digital Markets Act, it's a tough act. Then we talked to Dan Morin of Six Colors about Apple's upcoming September iPhone event, what we can expect, what we can maybe expect, and what we probably shouldn't expect, before we round things out with a fascinating article from Vulture all about Rotten Tomatoes and how the system is maybe hacked from time to time to give favored reviews. All of that coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 302, recorded Thursday, September 7th, 2023. EU names DMA gatekeepers. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Collide. Collide is a device trust solution for companies with Okta, and they ensure that if a device isn't trusted and secure, it can't log in to your cloud apps. Visit collide.com/TNW to book an on-demand demo today. And by Bitwarden. Get the open source password manager that can help you stay safe online. Get started with a free Teams or Enterprise plan trial, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. And by Brooklinen. Experience the difference for yourself and check out Brooklinen's new fall collection for bed and bath. Visit in-store or online at brooklinen.com and use code TNW for $20 off your online purchase of $100 or more, plus free shipping. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we, or in this case I, talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am your one host this week, Micah Sargent. Jason Howell will be back, but until then, you are with me. And I am very excited to kick off this show this week with an interview that I actually had a little earlier on. I wanted to talk to Wayne Ma of The Information about Apple's dabbling, perhaps, or maybe more than that, in AI. So take a listen to this. Alrighty, so I am really excited about this next interview because I have been thinking about what Apple and AI is going to mean for the company going forward. Joining us today to actually talk about what we could see in the future from Apple and AI is Wayne Ma of The Information, who has written a wonderful piece about this. Hello, Wayne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. So, you know, this is something that happened recently. I was at a interview show, and there were some Apple execs, including Craig Federighi on stage, and they kind of asked, "Okay, look, we're seeing all these companies doing chatbots and all sorts of different AI. Where is Apple in all of this?" And so, what we saw the execs talk about was, "Look, when it comes to AI, Apple's doing a bunch of AI. It's all behind the scenes. It's all the software. You know, we've been doing this for a long time." And so you kind of then from that point on heard that over and over again. If you're wondering about AI, well, technically it's what powers Siri. Technically it's what the ML chips are. It's kind of a party line at this point. And so I was kind of surprised in hearing that the company has actually been working on this kind of AI that we're about to talk about for a while. So can you tell us about how long ago Apple started researching LLM-based features and functionality, and then maybe explain how that specific kind of AI is different from something like the ability for me to tap and hold on a photo in the Photos app and have it lift that thing out of the background?
Sure. So, I guess at the very beginning, Apple, even though ChatGPT only came out last year, the research community, that machine learning research community, has known about large language models that power, you know, chatbots like ChatGPT for years. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in 2020, OpenAI released GPT-3, And that actually got the attention of lots of researchers, although not the general public. You know, it wasn't until the November that that happened. And so, you know, Apple laid the foundation for this by hiring the head of Google's AI and search in 2018. And so he set about to create this new organization called AIML that was separate from the software organization that was run by Craig Federighi. And, you know, he gave, you know, Apple wasn't known for AIML research. A lot of people didn't like to do AIML at Apple because they couldn't publish research papers. And that was one way to further your career. And Google allowed that as well. And, you know, Apple's culture is that you work on things that that ship. You know, they don't spend a lot of time doing long-term research on things that may not, you know, that may end up in dead ends. But Google was the opposite of that. You know, there's lots of people at Google just working on things that may never see the light of day. And so the former head of Google AI and search, John Ghinandria, he's known as JG within Apple and Google. He set about to kind of change that culture. You know, they created this new org, and he created all these research teams and hired. He convinced, he persuaded lots of people at Google to join him in the effort, to join him at Apple as well. And so by 2019, a year later, there were all the kind of chess pieces had been in place, you know, for Apple researchers to be able to kind of look at these kind of large language models. But at the time, of course, it was still kind of an emerging field. You know, people weren't really clear what these things could do. And so the team was very small at the very beginning in 2019.
Understood. Okay. So yeah, it kind of started out small, but they had their eye on the ball. It's just, we hadn't necessarily seen this externally. So, you know, I talked about them researching the features and functionality and kind of speaking of that, is Apple, as far as you understand it, as far as what they seem to be working on internally, is Apple's aim to create a Siri version of the chatbots we're seeing everywhere? I know that Snapchat chatbot was not a very popular feature that launched. So is that where Apple's going with this? Like, how is the company working on implementing this conversational AI, as they're calling it?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when OpenAI's ChatGPT came out, I thought to myself, oh, this would be perfect for Siri. But it turns out that people at Apple have been very dismissive of chatbots. They don't really see much use for them. And even prior to ChatGPT, they weren't really interested in having, you know, users having back and forth conversations with Siri. You know, they saw that as kind of like entertainment. Maybe some people liked it, but really they wanted to use Siri to get tasks done. You know, you ask Siri a question, it gives you the answer, and you tell Siri to turn on a light, it turns on a light. That's really what they, you know, wanted Siri to be. The other issue is that Apple's very careful about its brand, and it can't have chatbots hallucinating and, you know, being racist or aggressive with you. And that is and even like a very small thing, you know, could go viral if it happens anywhere in the world at any time. You know, Google and Microsoft do care about this, but just not as much, right? I mean, Apple's marketing, you know, the reason why they're great at selling products partially is because of their marketing. Right. So they've also always been very fearful of that and don't think they can control it. So really what they see, you know, what they want to use these models for is to understand your language rather than to generate language. They want to understand what your intent is, what you're saying. So, you know, you tell the iPhone, set a calendar to this date while playing a playlist and emailing me a reminder, all the while making sure to take a photo at this time. You know, you can say like four things at once. And now if they've trained a large language model, you know, to do this, it'll better understand what your meaning is, and it'll be able to translate that into tasks that will help you get more work done on the iPhone.
Okay, that's very clever. I'll be honest with you, I didn't quite pick that out in reading through the piece, outside of understanding that, yes, they were focused on essentially like using shortcuts, the app and the system as a means of interacting with AI. But the idea that gives the company the ability to kind of avoid any opportunities for a chatbot saying some stuff that it shouldn't be saying, that is very clever. And that's just something that, you know, I hadn't considered in Apple's sort of attempt to not play around in that space, but yes, to just be able to understand your intent better and to turn it into a language that then the computer can understand and do what it needs to do. That's fascinating. Now, one of the things that I think sticks out with this, you talk about how Apple's focus on device processing. They love to use that as a selling point. There's privacy implications. And so knowing that my device is doing a lot of this processing, is doing my face ID, all of that is a selling point for the company. So could this be at odds with conversational AI? And like, why is that the case for people who might not understand that?
Yeah, currently it is at odds. And the reason why is because, you know, these models, you know, require lots of data to train. And then once you've trained the models are huge, right? I mean, that's why they're called large language models rather than just language models. And so, you know, they can be tens of gigabytes, if not more than 100 gigabytes in size. And so they run on servers. So that, you know, and Siri ran like this at the beginning as well. You know, when Siri first came out, you would say a query and then it would send it to the cloud. And a server would process your query and then send back the task. The main issue with that was performance, but also privacy later on, you know, as Apple got more deep into wanting to protect user privacy. So a couple years ago, Apple started an initiative to actually move a lot of the Siri functions to your device. And you can see what functions work on your device and are processed by the iPhone processor and like a very small language model on the iPhone right now. You know, if you set a calendar or ask for a timer or ask what time it is, you can actually turn off, you know, turn on airplane mode and you can still get responses you couldn't before. But for these large language models right now, they're so large that you really can't run them on a phone. You have to run them in the cloud. Shortcuts is an example of this. Shortcuts runs actually on the device. It doesn't use the server to trigger any actions, you know, when you add different apps together and stream together into different tasks. But if they were to implement this in Shortcuts, you know, I think the big challenge is like, how would you do that and keep it on the device itself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's going to be an interesting solution. Now, we've seen many companies that have kind of popped up. They've built businesses out of integrating with OpenAI's GPT-3 and now GPT-4. And, you know, Microsoft, instead of creating its own large language model, decided to kind of tie its fate in with OpenAI. So when it comes to Apple and its experimentation and eventual product implementation with large language models, is the company creating its own large language model? Is it using what's already available? Kind of where does it stand in terms of all that, especially if at first it was a little bit going, I don't know if people are going to want to do this, and I don't know if we as a company want to do this.
Yeah, I mean, the company would never use someone else's language model. And that's because they want to control it. They want to actually... JG has been very public about how he feels like the data needs to be transparent. That, you know, what is the data that you trained it on? And OpenAI and some of these other companies haven't really explained what the data was that they used. Part of that is proprietary for them. So Apple wants to train its own models, and they have trained their own model. They have a very advanced model called Ajax GPT that's been trained in the last year. And people within Apple believe it exceeds the capabilities of GPT 3.5, which is the model that powered the initial version of ChatGPT when it was released in November. Since then, OpenAI has upgraded that to GPT-4, of course. And so, yeah, Apple has its own model. It's not clear if that model is going to be the one that's used for Shortcuts and some of these other things. You know, individual teams are siloed. Maybe they could train their own models as well. But at the end of the day, Apple wants to do everything in-house and not rely on somebody else's work.
That makes sense. And then in kind of reading through your piece, I did get the impression that we've got multiple teams within Apple working on these large language models, working on this idea of conversational AI. And so I know, you know, the name Ajax GPT is at the heart of at least one of those teams' projects. Are they all using Ajax GPT? Are they all kind of experimenting in their own way with their own language learning models? How is your understanding of how it works internally right now with the different teams that are playing around in this space?
Yeah, I mean, I think Ajax GPT is basically the focus of this one team called Foundational Models, the Foundational Models team at Apple. And so the concept, at least theoretically, is that that team creates the advanced models and other teams use them. But at Apple, it's not very clear. At Apple, you know, different teams are siloed from each other. You know, there's always competing products. Even the iPhone had, or the iPod had two different versions. So the iPhone had two different versions, you know, that were competing against each other internally.
Right.
And so it's very likely that multiple teams are training their own models, you know, of different sizes and capabilities as well. But it's clear. But from what I understand, Ajax GPT is the most advanced model within the company right now.
Understood. And then lastly, kind of a pull back sort of question. Your article suggests that we could see some of these features, at least in Apple's operating systems, as early as next year. But we do see other companies that have some of this feature or some of these features and functionality already built in. They've already put that stuff out there. And so just I'm curious from your general understanding of everything, kind of how does it compare? How does this approach compare to the other companies that have implemented this technology? And is Apple doing its typical sort of sit back and wait and try to do a better job in the space?
Yeah, part of it is sit back and wait, but the main issue is that the entire culture and planning of software revolves around the release of the iPhone every year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if something doesn't make it into the next version of iOS, it has to be pushed entire year to the next version. You know, they don't have like major updates usually during the year, right? Everything comes in September with the new iPhone, so it's already too late to implement anything this year, especially given Apple's strict, quality control standards and attention to detail and things like that. So the earliest you could see it would be in the next version of iOS in 2024. This year has kind of been ruled out.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, Wayne Ma, I want to thank you so much for taking some time. Of course, everyone needs to head over to the information and read this piece. It's really in-depth, well-sourced, and it's well worth your time. Of course, folks can head over to the information to check out your work, but is there anywhere else online that folks can stay up to date with what you're doing?
No, that's about it. That's really on Twitter, I guess. You can follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn. I guess that's where I post these articles. But if you want to read them, you'll have to subscribe.
Awesome. What is your Twitter handle?
Oh, it's just my name, Wayne Ma.
W-A-Y-N-E-M-A. All right. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate it and hope to see you again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
All right. That was a great interview with Wayne Ma over at The Information. And up next, we are going to take a look at the latest in the EU's new Digital Market Act update. The DMA has been around, but the updates to it now. We've finally got some companies in the sights of the EU. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But I do want to take a quick break to tell you about our first sponsor today. It's Collide, who are bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. Collide is a device trust solution for companies with Okta, and they ensure that if a device isn't trusted and secure, that it can't log in to your cloud apps. If you work in security or IT and your company has Okta, well, then listen up because this is the message for you. Have you noticed that for the past few years, the majority of data breaches and hacks you read about have something in common? It's employees. Sometimes an employee's device gets hacked because of unpatched software. Sometimes an employee leaves sensitive data in an unsecured place. And it seems like every day a hacker breaks in using credentials they phished from an employee. Employee. The problem here isn't your end users, though. It's the solutions that are supposed to prevent these breaches. But it doesn't have to be this way. Imagine a world where only secure devices can access your cloud apps. In this world, phished credentials are simply useless to hackers, and you can manage every OS, including Linux, all from a single dashboard. And this is what's the best part of it. You can get employees to fix their own device security issues without creating more work for your IT team. The good news is you don't have to imagine this world. You can just start using Collide. So visit collide.com/TNW to book an on-demand demo today and see how it works for yourself. That's KOLIDE.com/TNW. And our thanks to Collide for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. All right, so let's talk about the Digital Markets Act. This is the European Commission's act that is aimed at kind of trying to make sure that companies that are big tech companies don't have too much control over not only the end users, but also for the businesses who use these kind of big tech companies as part of the business that they do. Okay. So the Digital Markets Act is trying to make sure that everybody gets a fair chance. The EU itself says it is aimed at preventing gatekeepers from imposing unfair conditions on businesses and end users and at ensuring the openness of important digital services. Now, here's what's new? The EU has been tasked with trying to figure out who is kind of subject to this Digital Markets Act. Who are the companies that they're calling gatekeepers? And there are three rules that need to kind of be met in order for a company to be considered a gatekeeper. The size of the company and the impact on the internal market is one of those factors. So if a company achieves an annual turnover of at or above 7.5 billion euros in each of the last three financial years, or where its average market cap is equal to at least 75 billion euros in the last financial year, then it is one criteria met. Okay. Secondly, it needs to have control of what they call an important gateway for business users towards final consumers. So basically, if the company has a service that has more than 45 million monthly active users, and of course is located in the EU, and more than 10,000 yearly active business users in the EU in the last financial year. So they're looking at both just sort of end users like you or like me. And they're also looking at business users. So for example, a publication that uses Facebook to put out their news articles would be a business user who is actively using the service. And then last but not least, they have to meet this third criteria to be an entrenched to be in an entrenched and durable position. So if the company has met the second criterion in each of the last three financial years, meaning that if it has operated with more than 45 million monthly active end users and 10,000 yearly active business users over the last three financial years, that means that the company's been around long enough that it does so. So with that in mind, that's a lot of money, right? That's many a smackaroo. And so that would kind of limit the number of companies. That's $8 billion in annual turnover and 80.5 billion dollars. I'm going to US dollars now just to kind of compare in market cap. So that does limit the companies that are included. As of yesterday, the commission, who is tasked with determining what companies count as gatekeepers, have released those companies. Alphabet, Amazon. Oh, and Alphabet, of course, is Google's parent company. Amazon, Apple, ByteDance, which owns TikTok, Meta, which is the Facebook and Instagram parent company, and Microsoft are the six, quote unquote, gatekeepers, according to the Digital Markets Act Commission. So those six companies are having the sights set on them. And those six companies offer what are called core platform services that all have now specific regulations and rules tied to them. So social networks, including TikTok, which of course is ByteDance, Facebook, which is Meta, Instagram, which is Meta, and LinkedIn, which is Microsoft. Intermediation, like Google Maps, Google Play, Google Shopping, which is Alphabet, Amazon Marketplace, which is Amazon, the App Store, which is Apple's App Store, and the Meta Marketplace, which of course is Facebook's Meta Marketplace. Ads from Google, Amazon, and Meta. Browsers, including Chrome and Safari. Notably, Chrome and Safari, Chrome for Alphabet, Safari for Apple. What's not on there? Microsoft's Edge browser. Operating systems, Google Android, Apple's iOS, and of course, Windows from Microsoft. Search is just Google search. So once again, Bing is not on there. Video sharing, YouTube from Alphabet. And then messaging, WhatsApp and Messenger, which are both Meta-owned properties. Notably, iMessage not on that list. So there are a few that haven't made the list, and that is there are multiple reasons why this is the case. The commission is still working to determine some of these outliers, so to speak. So it's not necessarily the case that we won't eventually see iMessage make it, that we won't eventually see Microsoft make it. And in fact, Microsoft is currently under investigation with the rest of what's left off of that list. But if you're kind of curious what happens next, well, gatekeepers, the six companies I mentioned before, have 6 months to comply with the full set of obligations that the Digital Markets Act has put forth. And then they're also going to give a compliance report, or excuse me, each of the six companies have to provide a compliance report showing how they have figured out the solutions. This is what they're doing to follow the Digital Markets Act. That needs to happen by March of 2024 for these six companies that have now been labeled as gatekeepers. However, there are two obligations that start from the first day that a company has been designated as a gatekeeper. The gatekeepers are obligated to put in place a compliance function and are obligated to report on intended concentrations. So this means that they basically have to say, we, you know, recognize the compliance needs to happen, and we are reporting on what we plan to do to make this happen. The commission, of course, is going to continue to monitor the implementation. And if they don't implement the new fixes and they don't hold to these obligations, then come the fines. And these fines are not small fines. I'll quote again from the Digital Markets Act. In case a gatekeeper does not comply with the obligations laid out in the DMA, the commission can impose fines up to 10% of the company's total worldwide turnover. So 10% of the money, the turnover, and it can go up to 20% if the company continues to infringe on these regulations and obligations. This can go as far as to sort of empower even more remedies, like telling a gatekeeper that they have to sell parts of their business off if they want to operate in the EU, or completely banning one of these gatekeepers from acquiring any other companies and adding additional services to the business. So very steep fines, very steep remedies, as they're called, in order to do this. Now, what this means in terms of what the DMA is going to have to do, kind of boils down to some things we've heard of quite often. One is that companies will need to make it, or gatekeepers will need to make it easy for you to uninstall pre-installed applications. And if you can't simply uninstall those pre-installed applications, the option to just not have them installed in the first place needs to be one of the idea, one of the implementations. Essentially, the idea here is that you have to be able to be provided the choice for what applications you want to use. Gatekeepers also will have to make sure, and this is on the business side, that business users get access to all of the performance data whenever they're running ads, and that developers are able to use alternative in-app payment systems. So we've heard a lot about in-app payment systems being at the center of the problem with Apple's App Store, right? These companies are going to need to make sure that a developer can choose to use a different payment system from the one that's built in. And then interoperability options for messenger systems. And that is where we go back to that core platform service, seeing iMessage not on the list right now. This has been kind of an ongoing thing in the United States, where Android users and iOS users don't have the same messaging system that Apple's iOS and iPadOS and macOS all use iMessage as the system, and you can communicate with other iMessage users in data packages that are different from how you do an SMS or an MMS. And so it will be interesting to see when the EU makes this choice to include iMessage potentially on the list, how that is going to impact the interoperability of iMessage going forward. Now, all of these companies have said, hey, you know, we hear the EU, we're looking into it, we're going to see what's going on. Microsoft seems to be the most kind of, they're just, they their response, according to The Verge, has basically been, hey, cool, we hear this, and we are not only accepting this designation as a gatekeeper, but we also look forward to you investigating if our search engine, Bing, our browser, Edge, and our advertising services all need to be listed as part of this, you know, this compliance with the European Commission. Google and Apple and Meta as well, I guess, have all kind of said, hey, we are working with the EU to do what we can to make sure that this all flies according to the regulations. And we also are hoping that we can continue to offer great services, even if this is going to cause us headaches. So it's a little bit of a veiled way of saying we're going to do what we can to follow the letter of the law. We'll be compliant, but we don't want to have to like dive headfirst into these new regulations. And then what I found fascinating, according to The Verge, ByteDance has had a response that was a little bit more upset, we'll say. According to The Verge, TikTok has said that they, quote, fundamentally disagree with the decision. Quote, TikTok has brought choice to a space largely controlled by incumbents, and this decision risks undermining the DMA's stated goal by protecting actual gatekeepers from newer competitors like TikTok. We're extremely disappointed that no market investigation was conducted prior to this decision and are evaluating our next steps. Ooh, so TikTok's ByteDance is displeased, to say the least, with this, and we will see how this goes forward. So I'll quickly read through, or not read through, but summarize some of the obligations that gatekeepers will need to follow through with. And then we'll kind of leave it there. So end users will need to be able to uninstall pre-installed apps. We talked about that before, but also change default settings on their operating systems. So be able to choose their own browser. Virtual assistants, the same thing. If I don't want to have Siri or Samsung's, I don't even know what it's called these days, to be able to change that. And so that way, each individual will have the choice for what they want to use as their virtual assistant or their operating system's defaults. End users will need to be able to install third-party apps or use third-party app stores instead of just the first-party app store. End users will need to unsubscribe from core platform services as easily as they subscribe to them. So if, for example, you sign up for, Google's storage solution, and it's as simple as whenever you're setting up your phone, you just say yes and you log in, then it should be just as easy to say no afterwards. Gatekeepers will need to allow third parties to interoperate with the gatekeeper's own services. So again, we talked about that with like iMessage and others, although iMessage is not currently listed, so it's better to say WhatsApp. Provide the company's advertising on their platform with access to all of those tools. We talked about that early on. Allow business users to promote their offers and conclude contracts with their customers outside of the gatekeeper's platform. So not requiring that they use their the gatekeeper's own system as part of their means of getting in touch with their end users. So with Apple's App Store, if you want to reach out to your customers and you have your customers reach out to you, it's all sort of facilitated through Apple. And to have a third party way of doing that is or a third party option for doing that is what they're saying there. Provide business users with access to the data generated by their activities on the gatekeeper's platform. So basically getting more access to the information. A ban on using the data of business users when gatekeepers compete with them on their own platform. So Amazon is a good example here, or Google. I mean, anything that offers, if I am a third party and developer and I'm making a calculator app, then Apple shouldn't be able to use the information of my users using my calculator app to improve upon their own calculator app. A ban on ranking the gatekeeper's own products or services in a more favorable manner. So when I am doing a search in the App Store for calculator app, if Apple's calculator pops up ahead of mine and it isn't a sort of natural revelation of Apple's own app, but maybe it shows up with a blue edge around it so you know to tap on it. A ban on requiring app developers to use certain of the gatekeeper's services. So again, this is payment systems, identity providers, in order to appear in app stores of the gatekeeper. So this was very simply the way that some app stores require you to use their in-app purchase systems, their specific services. And then a ban on tracking end users outside of the gatekeeper's core platform service for the purpose of targeted advertising without effective consent having been granted by the end user. So unless you're saying, yes, you can track me when I'm not using your core services, then you are not allowed to do so. So they have some time, March of 2024 to be able to get this in place. But then those steep fines will start coming. The EU has said, we're aware that there are going to be some challenges brought against this. They've already got that kind of prepared for as they look to see how these gatekeepers that have now been named will respond. There's a great Q&A that we'll link to as well in the show notes from the EU itself. And it's kind of, or not Q&A rather, but a FAQ that goes in detail about the latest for the DMA. So be sure to check that out if you want to learn more about where things stand with the Digital Markets Act and the European Union. All right, up next, we are going to get a preview of Apple's upcoming September event. It's just around the corner. But first, I do want to take a moment to tell you about our next sponsor, which is Bitwarden. It's the only open source cross-platform password manager available anywhere, anytime. SecurityNow's Steve Gibson has even switched over. So if you are a SecurityNow watcher, you know Steve Gibson knows his stuff. Making that switch is big. With Bitwarden, all of the data in your vault is end-to-end encrypted, not just your passwords. In the summer of 2023 G2 Enterprise Grid report, they solidified their position as the highest performing password manager for the enterprise, leaving all of the competitors in the dust. Bitwarden protects your data and privacy by adding strong, randomly generated passwords for each account. You can go further with username generator that creates unique usernames for each account, or you can use any of the 5 integrated email alias services, like Fastmail. You can transparently view all of Bitwarden's code available on GitHub. On top of being public to the world, Bitwarden also has professional third-party audits performed yearly, and the results get published on their website. Bitwarden is open source security that you can trust. You can share private data securely with coworkers across departments or the entire company with fully customizable and adaptive plans. Bitwarden's Teams organization option is $3 per month per user, while their enterprise organization plan is just $5 per month per user. Individuals always get Bitwarden's basic free account for unlimited passwords. You can upgrade anytime to a premium account for less than $1 a month, or bring the whole family with their family organization option to give up to 6 users premium features for only $3.33 a month. Bitwarden just released a new passwordless SSO feature, that's single sign-on. Single sign-on with trusted devices lets users log into Bitwarden and decrypt their vault after using SSO on a registered trusted device. No master password needed. This new solution makes it even easier for enterprise users to stay safe and secure with Bitwarden. Learn more about SSO with trusted devices at bitwarden.com/twit. At Twit, we are fans of password managers, every single one of us. So get started with Bitwarden's free trial of a Teams or enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. All righty, folks, back from the break. And as you know, Apple's September event is just around the corner. You will be able to tune in live on Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific to watch Leo Laporte and I provide commentary during the events and its various announcements. But joining us ahead of the event to give us a preview of what we can probably expect is Six Colors' own Dan Morin. Welcome back to the show, Dan.
Good to be here, Micah. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes, always a pleasure to talk to you too. So let's kick things off with what we can almost certainly expect to have announced at Apple's September event. The September event seems to happen every year, and at every event, Apple announces blank. This is for you to fill in.
Oh, I like a good Mad Lib. That's a lot of fun. Every September event, well, pretty much, you know, asterisk, almost every. There's a new iPhone. So expect a new iPhone. It's that time of year. It's the time of year where you have to decide if you want to upgrade your iPhone to see what the new hotness is. This year, of course, the iPhone 15, assuming that they continue their traditional numbering pattern, we're not expecting any change to that. But the iPhone 15 and the 15 Pro are the most likely things to see at this event. What they will bring, there are still some questions about that, but there are a lot of rumors as well. You want to start with that, or you want to talk about the full, like, other things that we can expect to see? Because there's a lot of places to go here.
There are a lot of places to go. The places you'll go. And in fact, that is a good place to start, though. Let's start with iPhone 15. We've got the iPhone 14 right now, and it comes in iPhone 14 and iPhone 14 Pro variations with multiple sizes. Are we looking at the same thing this year where you've got the Pro and the non-Pro, and then you've got two different sizes in each category? And then if that's the case, what are the changes that we can look forward to this year? Sure. Why would someone maybe make that upgrade?
Yeah, so Apple has in the last few years worked on a very sort of a two-year strategy with its models in the sense of the different assortment available. So for a couple of years, we had, you know, the iPhone 15, a smaller like version of that, or iPhone, the standard iPhone, the iPhone Pro, a larger version of that. And then last year they swapped the mini phone for the Plus phone. So there was the iPhone 14, the 14 Plus, and then the 14 Pro and the 14 Pro Max. Super fun and confusing. This year we're expecting that to operate on pretty much the same thing, since they seem to give it at least a couple of years to see how that model lineup sort of shakes out. So expect your 15 and your 15 Plus to have, so the same sizes as last year, along with the Pro lineup that has the same sort of corresponding sizes in the 15 Pro and the 15 Pro Max. As far as what you can expect this year, the big change that everybody is talking about is that after more than a decade, Apple will swap out the Lightning port that it's been using for charging, data transfer, audio connections, that kind of thing, in favor of a USB-C port. Obviously, that's going to cause a shakeup for some people in terms of replacing cables and accessories. But since a lot of people do have USB-C cables around, they're more of a standard. There is the advantage that maybe you already have these cables handy. Besides that, it seems like the dynamic island from the 14 Pro line last year is going to make its way down to the standard iPhone as well. There's a couple other little changes along the way. The 15 Pro and Pro Max are expected to use titanium instead of steel for that outer ring. This has the biggest benefit of being lighter. Titanium is much lighter than steel, so that could make those phones lighter than they have previously been. And then on the higher-end Pro models, we're also expecting to see a new chip architecture using Apple's most recent 3-nanometer process. This will probably be dubbed the A17, whereas the standard iPhone 15 models will get the A16 chip, which was in the Pro last year. So Apple's now started to do this thing where they trickle down their highest-end processors from year to year rather than all of them having the same processor. And then the other question that's still floating around there is there are rumors that the Pro models will get a price increase as well, around $100. Unclear whether or not that's true, but that's sort of possibly in the offing.
Interesting. A price increase. Now, this always leaves me wondering, from your understanding, from, you know, your experience, are people aware of that price increase? Or, you know, as far as you've seen and experienced, is it the case that that people are not buying these phones outright, but are doing it through some sort of carrier plan or maybe even Apple's own iPhone upgrade plan. How much of an impact do you think a price hike is going to have on people's purchases of the latest phones?
Well, since the price hike seems to be, and again, this is based on speculation, we don't know this for sure yet, but since it seems to be targeted at the Pro phones, which are already the most expensive phones in the lineup, I don't think it will have as much of an impact for a couple different reasons. One, as you allude, a lot of people use installment plans or upgrade programs, so they will still see an increase, but if it's more on the order of $5 or $6 a month, they may not feel like that hits their wallet as much. Second, by targeting the highest end phones, Apple is making it to the point where it's sort of guessing that the people who are buying these phones are already, you know, pretty financially comfortable because they're buying these expensive phones. They're buying the Pro phones, right? They're not buying the vanilla sort of iPhone 15. And I think it's taking the gamble that people at that level aren't going to care about an extra $100. Or like, even if they do, it's like, well, you know, there are cheaper phones available. If you're buying something because you want that Pro phone and you want the phone that's the best phone that's out there, I think they're sort of taking the approach of thinking like, well, you'll pay an extra $100 to have that if that's what's important to you. And I'm not sure they're wrong about that. I think the Pro phones have done very well for Apple in their overall mix of the phone lineup. So people will be aware of it. And I expect, as always, there's probably going to be some grumbling, but I kind of expect it not to have a real impact on the sales of the phone.
Now, when Apple changed a charging port in years past, there was a lot of that grumbling. But this time around, a charging port change would shift the charger, the charging port and the, you know, necessary cables into a place that would, in I think in many cases, make it so that people have more cables than they have had before, because a lot of other gadgets and gizmos have gone USB-C or have been USB-C for a long time. So I'm curious, in your crystal ball predictions, are we going to see a lot of grumbling about a potential change to USB-C? And of course, part of the reason for Apple potentially making this change, again, this whole segment is a speculation segment, but part of this is because of requirements overseas for Apple, like every tech company, to provide USB-C charging, as that is now the blessed port. But Apple doesn't operate from a position of weakness. And so they are all about selling the change. So what do you think it's going to look like and sound like if Apple announces USB-C, a USB-C port on the iPhone?
Yeah, so you're totally right. Apple is going to talk about how great this is, right? We saw them with the iPhone 7 remove the headphone jack and sell it as the most courageous decision anybody's made in the history of smartphones. I fully expect something along those lines again, and I'm sure they will downplay any impact that regulation had on this. And the truth is, I'm sure the regulation played a part, but I don't think it was the only thing. I went back and was watching the introduction of the Lightning port back in 2012, and one of the things that Phil Schiller, who at the time introduced it, mentioned was that this was a modern port for the next decade, and it's been more than a decade, so it's not exactly surprising. I mean, we've talked about grumbling when there's been they've changed the charging port before, but it's worth remembering they've only really done it once so far. I mean, they went from a 30-pin dock connector, which debuted on an iPod back in 2003, to the Lightning cable, and that lasted, I think, 9 years. The Lightning cable's been around even longer than that. So yes, people are going to grumble because they're going to have to change some cables. The blow is a little softer this time for a couple of reasons. One, as you mentioned, a lot of people have USB-C cables from other devices they own because this transition has been in place across the industry over the last several years. Two, I think fundamentally people physically connect their iPhone for fewer things. When the dock connector port changed to the Lightning port more than a decade ago, people had speaker docks and accessories and things that plugged into their iPhones and their iPods. And in some cases, they'd had those things going back to like an older iPod. And so they could just slot their phone in and it would be super convenient. These days, I think that's less the case. Moreover, because we have different technologies for connecting to a lot of those things, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, AirPlay, all these things have made life easier to the point where you don't really have to plug your phone into anything except basically to charge. And even in the case of Apple, they've also, you know, embraced the Qi wireless charging standard and, of course, have rolled out their own MagSafe charging standard. And so those things, if you invested in MagSafe cables like a year ago or 2 years ago when you bought your iPhone or a Qi charger that sits by your bedside, those things will still work with the next phone. So I think there will be an outcry, but I don't think it's going to reach the sort of pop culture zeitgeist that it did a decade ago when the 30-pin dock connector changed to Lightning.
That's well put. So outside of the iPhone and new titanium and faster processor and all of that jazz, do you like jazz? I'm curious if there's anything else we can expect or should expect at Apple's September event this time around. Are we getting any one more things? Are we getting new Apple Watches? What else is rumored to be at this next event?
Yeah, so there are some rumors about other devices. I think the Watch series is the most likely thing to get a revision. The Watch often goes hand in hand with the iPhone because obviously it's kind of positioned as an iPhone accessory. There are a lot of questions about what an Apple Watch Series 9 might look like. We aren't expecting any major like new health sensors or anything like that, which isn't to say they couldn't happen, but there hasn't been a lot of talk about it. The biggest sort of rumor around that is a new version of the S Series chip that powers the Apple Watch, which would be based probably on the A15 line, which would offer better performance, possibly better battery life. There may have some conversations about new colors available for the watch as well. But beyond that, we don't really know a lot about what is going to be offered there. And then, of course, the other question mark is the Apple Watch Ultra. That was introduced last year, and it's been a really big hit as far as we can tell. And so there are some questions about, will we see a Apple Watch Ultra 2? Will we perhaps just see a new color option? Black titanium has been thrown out there as something that we could see. And we may just see some other sort of refresh cosmetically that doesn't actually change the innards of the watch. There's also some talk of new manufacturing processes using 3D printing instead of using the traditional sort of CNC like milled cases that they've used before. And then other than that, you know, there's a lot of stuff about accessories out there. Whether there will be a USB-C AirPods case to replace the current case, whether there'll be new iPhone cases and Apple Watch bands, those sorts of accessory stories. But nothing that has really been out there that makes us think like, oh, there's going to be a surprise new product, right? I don't think that's likely to happen this time around.
Yeah, that's my expectation as well. Now, one thing that sometimes happens at September events is with the introduction of new hardware, we will see something that will suddenly be activated in the operating system. So, for example, in years past, we saw the Dynamic Island that, you know, we had been testing, iOS all the way leading up to the September event and did not know that this Dynamic Island was coming. And suddenly this in software mixed with hardware kind of feature was revealed. Are there any rumors about anything like that, that the hardware will take advantage of the software in a way that we had not expected? Or has all of that kind of been pretty clear up to this point?
Yeah, I mean, the Apple does like to keep a surprise or two up its sleeve. It would not surprise me at all to hear that there was something that the hardware unlocked in terms of the capabilities in the latest version of iOS that will be available. We have heard, of course, that there is a possibility for a new camera on the iPhone Pro line, possibly only on the Pro Max. That could open the door to some new camera modes or camera options that would only be available to that new hardware. But beyond that, if there's something in there that Apple's holding back, they've done a good job of keeping it under wraps for the moment. So, yeah, we don't really know of any software features coming. But, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see something make that appearance there.
All right. Last, I will just ask anything that you are looking forward to seeing at this event, or kind of are you fully aware of what's going to happen and therefore are not, you know, expecting any surprises or anything that's going to be of particular interest?
I always like a good surprise. There's nothing out there right now. I would certainly love to see a little bit more about the Vision Pro, which they talked about back at WWDC. I don't really expect to because they give it a lot of time at WWDC, and it seems like we're still a ways out from it shipping. So I don't think they're going to basically do much other than maybe say, oh, we showed this off. Personally, I'm in the market to replace my Apple TV, and I might hope that maybe there's an announcement in that vein, possibly even just some cheaper prices because those are still pretty expensive, but I have no real expectation of that either. The one wild card I would like to see, as long as we're making this USB-C transition, is a replacement for some of the company's Mac accessories, like the Magic Keyboard and the Magic Trackpad that rely on Lightning cables, and replace those with USB-C. But I think it's far more likely those will appear later in the fall as part of some sort of Mac event. So, yeah, not a lot here that I'm like really waiting for, but I'm excited to see if there's anything that hasn't leaked to make it out there.
Oh man, that's a good one. I would love to see that too. As I stare down at this pesky port on my keyboard.
I'm with you. Yeah. I hate anything to replace those Lightning cables. I want to go all USB-C as soon as possible.
That would be awesome. Well, Dan Morin, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Of course, folks can head over to sixcolors.com to check out your work there. But is there anywhere else they should go to follow along with what you're doing online?
Sure. You can find all of my stuff, including my novels and my other writing at dmorin.com. I'm on Mastodon at zeppelin.flight/@dmorin. And of course, you can find me every week over at Relay FM on Wednesdays for the Clockwise podcast with my good host, a fellow named Micah Sargent.
Oh, I know him. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Dan.
Thanks. See you later.
Bye-bye. All righty. Up next, I've got another story of the week for you. And it's a little squishy, a little moldy, and a little wet. So we'll get to that in a moment. But I do want to take, I don't know what all of you are thinking, but I can't wait to tell you what this story is about. But I do want to take a quick break to tell you about our next sponsor of Tech News Weekly. It's Brooklinen. Fall, it's finally here. Thank goodness. And now is the perfect time to upgrade your bedding collection with cozy season home essentials from Brooklinen. Yes, it's cozy season. It's cuffing season. It's time to cuddle up. And you can do so with Brooklinen. I've talked about it plenty. My Brooklinen sheets are incredible. I have the classic percale sheets that have this nice weave that is breathable. I will continue using them into the fall because yes, that is how warm I sleep, that it doesn't matter if it's 0 degrees Fahrenheit outside, I'm still rocking some breathable sheets. But I love these sheets. They are incredibly resilient. They're super soft. They do feel very luxurious. And I've talked before about the pillows. I love the pillow cases that they have because of the deep pocket that they have. So you put the pillow in and then it has that pocket, that envelope enclosure so that the pillow doesn't fall out of the pillowcase. It's those little touches that make this so great. And Brooklinen was founded by husband and wife duo Rich and Vicky back in 2014. They had a simple mission. It was to provide their customers with hotel quality luxury bedding. Brooklinen's options are endless, and so you can kind of save yourself some time, simplify your shopping by bundling your bed, your bath, or perhaps even both. Brooklinen is the one-stop shop for comfort, making your home upgrade feel effortless. Now, while there's no such thing as the perfect sleep, although I can get pretty close, there is the ideal fabric for every sleeper. You can cool off with Brooklinen's crisp, classic percale weave like I have, or you can try their best-selling buttery smooth luxe sateen sheets. Those are the sheets that Leo has. Brooklinen uses only the highest quality materials for their products, such as long staple cotton, so everything they create is built to last. They are resilient sheets. I've washed them a bunch since I've gotten them, and they're still doing just fine. In fact, they've just gotten softer over time. It's really nice. Brooklinen is the internet's favorite sheet. Wirecutter and Good Housekeeping both agree Brooklinen has best-in-class bedding. So if you need more evidence than their 100,000 five-star customer reviews, you know these experts have done the research. Experience the difference for yourself and check out Brooklinen's new fall collection. Visit in-store or online at brooklinen.com and use code TNW for $20 off your online purchase of $100 or more, plus free shipping. That's BROOKLINEN.com and the promo code TNW for $20 off your online purchase of $100 or more, plus free shipping. My hearty thanks to Brooklinen for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. All righty, it is time for my final story of the week. This time, as I promised, it's about something squishy, moldy, and wet. It's Rotten Tomatoes. So I wanted to talk about this because I have to be honest. I am a person who says I don't use reviews to determine what I watch, but because Rotten Tomatoes is everywhere, I do use a Rotten Tomatoes review or rating as a means of determining if it's something that I'm going to watch. I'm admitting that to myself right now as much as I'm admitting it to all of you. It's partially because it's so prolific that I can look, you know, if I'm browsing through media content and I see a percentage, I almost certainly know it's regarding Rotten Tomatoes, that is the Rotten Tomatoes rating. And what I didn't know was the scoring system, the scoring method, the whole kit and caboodle of how Rotten Tomatoes works. Many of you probably did know this or do know this. But Rotten Tomatoes, the rating is a grouping of scores. Okay. So many sites out in the world, will review a movie or a title, I guess would be the best way to put it. And with those reviews, Rotten Tomatoes will combine them together and provide a rating based on those reviews. Now, according to a Vulture article, this is what the story of the week is about. The scores classify each review as either positive or negative, and then they take the number of positive reviews and divide that number by the total. And then the percentage they're left with, that's the percentage that the movie gets. So it doesn't matter if the review is coming from a blog that, you know, 50 people visit, or if it's coming from a reputable critic who's had years in the business of doing movie reviews. If it's a positive review or a negative review, those are factored in. The positive reviews are then divided by the total number of reviews, and that's where the percentage comes from. So that's something to understand first and foremost, that it's not necessarily entirely reputable reviewers who are providing part of the rating for the film. And secondarily, something else that's, you know, important to understand is that it's either good or it's bad. There's no gray area. So one director talked about how, you know, occasionally you'd have a review where someone says, look, this movie was not a movie that I enjoyed, but the parts that I didn't enjoy, I was very impressed with how the director of the film pulled off this movie that I didn't enjoy, right? And overall, that is, you know, could be considered an applause to the director saying that, look, you pulled it off, you just didn't pull it off for me. And so if that is the review, that is going to be considered a negative review by Rotten Tomatoes, whereas it might not be a negative review if it were something that you read. And that's where Rotten Tomatoes actually came along in the first place. People went from reading individual reviews to wanting to just have a quick way to know if a movie was, quote unquote, certified fresh or not. So they decided to do this sort of grouping of all of the reviews that were out there, many of the reviews that were out there, and give people a quick way to know, here's what the critics are thinking about this film or not thinking about this film. What I didn't know also, according to this Vulture piece, is that Rotten Tomatoes is owned by two companies that make movies, and then also owned by a company that sells tickets to movies. So Rotten Tomatoes is owned by Warner Bros. It's also, or Warner Brothers, it's also owned by Fandango. And Fandango, its parent company is Universal Pictures. So Warner Bros. And Universal Pictures and Fandango all own Rotten Tomatoes, which I don't know if you see it this way, but sort of feels like a conflict of interest if you ask me. That alone is something to kind of keep in mind, to bear in mind. But this Vulture piece kind of talks about how important to the movie industry Rotten Tomatoes is, but how easily gamified, or not gamified, hacked Rotten Tomatoes can be. The piece starts out talking about a publicity company that is occasionally hired to help get a better score for films. And so a film had a score that was less than 50% on Rotten Tomatoes, and they worked to raise that score so that more people would see it. And in the piece, they kind of talk over time about how, how the way that films are rated, when they're rated, how they're rated, has an impact on the, or has a potential impact on the box office for that film. So one example was a film that ended up getting very few reviews. It was a title from 2022, and it was screened at a festival. And when it was screened at the festival, it got some reviews. It ended up with 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. And the publicist was like, hey, look, that isn't, there aren't many reviews. Even though you have 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, we should get some more reviews out there. The movie studio said, no, we don't want to ruin our perfect 100%. So let's not screen it to any more before we release it for it to go to the box office. So they kept it at 100%. That film ended up winning an Oscar. Now, did it win an Oscar because it had 100% review on Rotten Tomatoes? Did it win an Oscar because it had so many people going to see it? Did it win an Oscar because it was worth 100% of Rotten Tomatoes? You don't know. I love, too, that in this Vulture piece, they do cite some studies that have looked at how a Rotten Tomatoes score actually impacts box office numbers. Up to this point, it looks like it doesn't have too much of an impact, but it also started to show that maybe that was changing, that Rotten Tomatoes was starting to have an impact. But the organization that did the study pointed to the fact that that may have been because of the pandemic and how that could have shifted people's behaviors. And so they didn't want to conclude that it did have that much of an impact without factoring in more data over time. So they're kind of continuing to review this. But I don't know. Ultimately, for me, what this did was it opened my eyes a little bit to, A, you always got to follow the money, right? And that's important in research. That's important in so much. I didn't know that Rotten Tomatoes was owned by two movie distributors and a ticket sales company. That has its own implications. There's been, over time, a shift from, and let me just actually do a direct quote from the Vulture piece. Quote, according to a study by Global News in 2016, the average, now some people say tomatometer, some people say tomato meter. The average tomato meter score for all wide releases was in the rotten low 50s. But by 2021, that average had climbed to a fresh 60%. So in the before times, when Rotten Tomatoes was more independent, to now in 2021, more films are appearing as fresh. And that is something to keep in mind. So we follow the money, we keep that in mind. And then we follow the, I guess it's just more money, frankly, that this system can be gamed with proper timing, with proper choices on who the film is sent to. And I don't want to give away the whole piece because that doesn't lead value back to the Vulture article. But let's just say, in talking about the movie publicity company, they talk about some of the behaviors of the folks who work at the movie publicity company who reach out to journalists and maybe try to get positive reviews. So that it's definitely worth reading to learn a little bit more about that. But just in general, this for me was kind of a, maybe I should pay more attention to individual reviews as opposed to this sort of average review rating that Rotten Tomatoes provides, and not necessarily use that as a means of determining if I'm going to like a film or series that is published online. So yeah, go read the Vulture piece about the decomposition of Rotten Tomatoes, as it's entitled. What a great title. It is quite good, and great work from Lane Brown over at Vulture. Folks, that is going to bring us to the end of this very episode of Tech News Weekly. We do publish the show every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. So head there. If you're not subscribed, subscribe there to the show in audio and video formats, your choice. If you would like to get all of our shows ad-free, well, we do have a way for you to do that. You can check out Club Twit at twit.tv/clubtwit. When you join the club, starting at $7 a month or $84 a year, you will get some great stuff. First and foremost, every single Twit show ad-free. It's all the content, none of the ads, because you, in effect, are supporting the shows. You'll also get access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else, behind the scenes, before the show, after the show. Also, Club Twit events get published there. So you, when you subscribe, will get access to a huge back catalog of content. That's so exciting. As well as the members-only Discord server, a fun place to go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members and those of us here at Twit. Now, I said starting at $7 a month, not because it's a tiered subscription, but because some folks said, hey, look, we're getting a lot of value out of this, and you have one of the least expensive subscription costs in all of the memberships. We'd like to give you some more money. So we've given you the ability to do that. You can pay $7 a month. You can pay more than $7 a month. It will give you access to the same thing. You get access on top of all of that to some Club Twit exclusive shows. The Untitled Linux Show. There's Hands on Windows, which is a short format show from Paul Thurrott that covers Windows tips and tricks. My Hands on Mac Show, which is a short format show that covers Apple tips and tricks. The Home Theater Geeks program from Scott Wilkinson, which is going to help you figure out all sorts of you know, questions, but also gadgets, gizmos, products. It's everything to do with home theater. And Jason Howell's new artificial intelligence show, which is part of the club. So please consider joining twit.tv/clubtwit to join the fun, to join the club. We would love to have you there. If you'd like to tweet at me or follow me or see what I'm up to, you can find me on many a social media network at Micah Sargent, or head to chihuahua.coffee. That's chihuahua.coffee. That's the place where I've got most of my links. You can also check me out later today if you're a club member. You can watch Hands on Mac, which will publish here pretty soon. Or you can watch on Sundays Ask the Tech Guys, the show that I co-host with Leo Laporte, where we take your questions online and do our best to answer them. We take your questions live on air and do our best to answer them. And Tuesdays, you can watch iOS Today with Rosemary Orchard and yours truly, where we cover all things iOS, tvOS, watchOS, etc. Huge thanks, as always, to our producer, our technical director, and our editor, John Ashley, to Burke, who is our engineering member, who makes sure that we are good to go with our guests, that they sound great, to John Slanina in the studio as well, who leads off the studio engineering. We appreciate it. And of course, we appreciate all of you out there who not only tune in each week or have subscribed, but also who I know are telling their friends and family members about this very show. Thank you so much. We will see you next week for another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye-bye.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time.